A leading AI CEO and entrepreneur joins us to talk about the state of the field, the research, products, competition, and where this is all heading. All that and more coming up right after this.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by HubSpot. Imagine growing a business with high-quality leads, fast-closing deals, and wildly happy customers. It's not a miracle. It's HubSpot. Visit HubSpot.com to get started today.
LinkedIn presents.
Welcome to Big Technology Podcast, a show for cool-headed, nuanced conversation of the tech world and beyond. Today, we have a great guest for you, someone I've been trying to bring on for months, and I'm very excited to have him here. Sohail Doshi is here. He's the CEO and founder of Playground, which is an AI image generation and editing software company. Somebody that I've been following on Twitter pretty religiously to get a sense as to like where this is all heading. So I'm thrilled he's here. Sohail, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Alex.
Thanks for being here. I always end up learning about like the latest breakthroughs through your Twitter account. You're like definitely on it. You're talking with the right people. You have a sense as to where this is going. So just to start this conversation on that theme, where are we right now in terms of the curve, you know, the curve of the innovation curve? Are we at the early part? Are we kind of troughing here? And I'm also curious to hear just kind of a two-parter. Where do you think the business cases for this stuff are going to land? Because I think that's still a kind of an open question. I mean, you run an image generation company, an editing company. So that's something I'm sure you think about because you have to figure out who you're going to sell to. So yeah, let's just start real broad to begin with.
Yeah, in terms of where we are, gosh, I am always surprised how, you know, I used to have this tweet last year that there were AI breakthroughs every single week.
Right.
And eventually I got to the point where I think like Elon Musk tweeted every single day. And the interesting thing is that it still feels like that's happening, right? I try to follow just the right people, researchers. You know, I troll through this place where all the research papers get uploaded called Archive. And I just read through things that are interesting, that are kind of taking off. Sometimes these things are good demos and they're nothing more than a good demo. But sometimes they are truly breakthroughs. So right now the pace continues to seem relentless. You know, I'm often surprised by what new thing happens. And what's interesting is sometimes a breakthrough will happen in a week, and it's only like a couple days later that something beats that thing in terms of performance or capability or some sort of surprise. But if I were to take a snapshot about roughly where we are right now, it has been over a year since GPT-4 has basically been out. I view it as a little bit over a year because I was a lucky person and I had access around October to GPT-4. And I think it kind of came out around February. And so it's interesting. I think it's interesting to point at that milestone because we don't know what has been internally happening at a company like OpenAI over the last year. And they're definitely training a new model. So the question, and so I had this thought today that was kind of like, we don't really know how far behind everybody else is in language because we have no idea what OpenAI or Anthropic or some other company is training internally. We have markers for things like Gemini from Google, or we have markers from Mistral, but we really don't know how far behind they are. We only know where they are matching compared to last year or the year before that in October. That's in language. And in images, images is interesting because it's probably a couple years behind a GPT-4 true moment, right? And now audio is starting to happen with a company called Suno that I actually tried out this weekend. I'm a producer, so I was making songs. So I was trying that out. So I have some weird thoughts about that. And then I think the last area is the companies that are doing 3D are just starting to get started. There's a friend of mine who's starting like a 3D foundation model to do like Pixar level type of creation.
Wow.
I don't know if I can name them yet, so I'll probably avoid doing that.
Yeah,
for
but
now.
Even the fact that's happening is very
but it's getting it's
and there's
yeah,
video.
Yeah, and there's video. Yeah, now we're getting like minute long sequences that are not kind of artifacty. They're sort of more coherent with the right character consistency. We are at the very beginning, I think.
So what is the North Star for this stuff? I'm trying to think about a chatbot, like, or a GPT model, right? So, okay, it's already pretty good. Like, it does a great job of synthesizing information and spitting stuff back. Like, where does it end? Because you mentioned, okay, they're working on a new model. Well, how's that new model going to be an improvement from what we have? And then where do we end up getting to if this keeps on getting better and better?
I mean, Sam Altman's response will be like AGI, right?
Yes. What's yours?
I think there's another version of his belief, which is like, one time when we were talking with Sam, just kind of at a dinner party, I think he said this thing that he believed that everybody would just like have 1,000 employees. And I think we all thought he was crazy. Still do, by the way. he may prove to be right. But I think chatbots are just like a very like sort of very basic, primitive thing that we'll end up getting. You know, my general feeling is that I was talking to someone at OpenAI who was working on the robotics team there back in the day. And I was starting to get into AI robotics a little bit. I was kind of curious where things were. And the general, you know, to summarize kind of like where the field seems to be, I'm not an expert, but I've talked to enough people that are, that, you know, broadly, robotics kind of asymptoted and hit a ceiling about like 3 or 4 years ago. And the research still isn't like kind of on a trajectory that's amazing. But the reason why I'm bringing robotics is because I want to answer your question about where I think things are headed, is that there was a belief for a little while, someone at OpenAI at least had this belief, can't say that it was everybody there, that the ceiling due to robotics was in part because maybe the solution to solving it was actually through large language models first. Maybe if we could find a model that could reason to the extent of language, that maybe that could help the robots sort of navigate through some of the toughest problems that they're having trouble with. And so it's kind of like the sequence is sort of like, first, make language great. And now we're starting to see, and then the second thing we start to see is image models and graphics becoming great. And then the next piece is, now we're starting to get a sense of multimodal vision plus language plus maybe audio. Can we make a very powerful multimodal model? And if we can do that, maybe those will surface and cause many breakthroughs, one of which could be in robotics, one of which means that you'd have a robot, not a Roomba, like a robot that, you know, maybe embodies us. Like, you know, there are a lot of humanoid startups right now. And by the way, the reason why the humanoid startups are humanoids and not different looking robots is because we know that humans are already able to generalize to lots of human-related things, right? We know that if we're human, we look like a human, then we can hit a printer button and take a box and, you know, do all these different activities. So I think that if the models get more powerful, we're probably going to see some kind of Westworld version of the world. We're going to go way beyond a chatbot.
And what about reasoning? Because OpenAI had this Q-star thing that people were talking about. There's another company that says they've been able to reason. Is the adding reasoning into large language models, is that like another next new bound, or is that just a way to get us to this reality that you're talking about?
Man, reasoning and AI is kind of like this very, really big philosophical word, I think, amongst researchers. You work with a research team, you talk to researchers. Reasoning is really tough for anyone to really prove whether that's actually happening or not.
Right, because the big question is it just like spitting back the next word, or is it really able to like work through problems on its own, which...
I mean, how do we know you're reasoning or I'm reasoning right now? How do we know we're not doing that? How do we know we're not just reacting to our surroundings and predicting the next token? We don't really know.
Interesting. But then why do you think that there are AI companies that are working on this problem? I mean, it's not an abstract thing. Like, there's actual research programs and progress that are being made on this question itself. You know, I think the Q-star example, from what I've read, is that it basically can solve complex math problems on its own. So that requires being able to conceptualize and reason through a problem, as opposed to like take all, you know, and it could do novel problems. So as opposed to like take what you've seen before and spit out something that looks like an answer to a math problem.
Yeah, I mean, just to dive into the philosophy of reasoning, just for like just the tip of the iceberg, I think that you know, just because something is able to articulate its reason for getting to an answer doesn't mean that it is necessarily reasoning.
Interesting.
The one way that you could prove reasoning is maybe, you know, like one hap, because it's possible that its training data you know, it's just really tightly fit to its training data, and it kind of knows, it just happens that the next token ends up being step one and then step two and step three. We don't really know. But I think one way that you could maybe litmus test reasoning is if you gave the model something truly out of distribution, right? Like an example of something that's truly out of distribution that humans faced was COVID, a pandemic that it had not yet seen before. And then we had to reason about how we would go and deal with that kind of odd current event. You know, the question would be like, could you, if you gave a model something that it was truly not trained on, if you could prove that it was not trained on, and you gave it, you asked it for a solution, could it really figure out the right solution? Mm-hmm. That might be really hard. We might find that really difficult. And humans don't necessarily do either, right?
Well, it's interesting because when people talk about like artificial general intelligence, it's like, well, who's your baseline? Because,
right.
I don't know. We'll see. I mean, AI can definitely exceed humans in some areas and others it can't. So anyway, it'll be something that we'll all be talking about for a while. Obviously, like image generation is something that requires some understanding of the world you're doing it at playground, right? That image will understand, like, let's say you say, you know, show me a monkey sitting on a beach ball, will understand that there's some physics in the world and the monkey has to sit on top of a beach ball. So I'd love to hear your perspective on the state of image generation right now. You have an update that you're releasing, or you have released by the time this goes live. Obviously it's an exciting time, but you're also coming up against some very big companies that are trying to do this as well. Midjourney's been at it for a while. DALL-E 3 is pretty impressive. I use it through Copilot from Microsoft. Google, of course, has tried it, but they've had some problems there. So talk a little bit about it. And also, I'd love to hear like the business case here, because, you know, for LLMs, that's one thing. Like you can say, all right, we'll read contracts, understand them, help spit back. But for images, you know, is it that it will replace design, or that it will democratize design and make it available to everyone else? Like, I'm curious to hear your perspective on why that's a problem to work on.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, images are definitely behind in terms of overall capability and utility relative to language. You know, like I think at the end of the day, all of these models for the time being have their kind of narrow somewhat utility, right? You know, there are a lot of things posted on Twitter about how people are using language models, but the predominant use case continues to be homework. And then there's kind of this other one that's like coding. For images, it just turns out that the predominant use case is making art. And it just turns out, and it's very surprising, but it just turns out that millions of people are very excited to make art. And art can be, it's not art that you're going to necessarily always put on your wall, but it's art that could be used in marketing. Like maybe you post it on your Instagram, or maybe you make an icon and you use it as an icon for your app, or maybe it's a YouTube thumbnail, or it's an image that you put in a blog post. Maybe it's just a fun meme that you send a friend. That's some of the state of images right now. It's really interesting, imaginative art. But I think that it hasn't quite gotten to the utility of language. And I think there are a number of things that are probably coming for graphics. I do think it's going to be about democratizing graphics for people. I mean, our company is trying to help people make graphics like a pro without being one. You shouldn't have to, if you ever open up Photoshop, I mean, there's a dizzying amount of menus, right? There's all these icons. You have to go to YouTube and do a really sophisticated tutorial to be good at Illustrator or Photoshop or Lightroom.
I had to take classes on both of those, Photoshop and Illustrator, right. Semester-long classes to be able to do that stuff.
Right. Yeah. There was a summer where I grinded just making logos, and then I would upload them to SitePoint and try to win logo contests to get better at my own skills back in high school when I was a lot younger. And it doesn't have to be that way anymore. Right. I think the first thing that's going to happen is that a lot of graphics are going to be able to be capable on the model. Maybe, you know, if you have wedding pictures and you wish you could like color grade them somehow, maybe you'd use Lightroom or something for that. I think an image model would be very good at that.
I know you're about to move on, but graphic designers, do they become like an extinct profession, or where do they go? Because you can not only create images within Playground, you can edit them.
No, I mean, look, like Walt Disney started as person that drew pictures, and then he worked somewhere where he animated them. And then that just like evolved. And eventually we got to 2D cartoon movies like Snow White and things like that. Right. And then things like Pixar came about, and we built like a 3D rendering engine. So did all the people that, people that drew the 2D cartoons, did they lose their jobs? And, you know, that was the end of an era. Definitely not. People retooled. The stories that came from them were still really material to their creative process. Story matters more for a company like Disney, mm-hmm. Pixar, than the animation itself. So I think in this case, you know, the graphics matter, but I think that people will retool.
Right.
The question is, are we giving people enough time to retool?
Yeah. So like if you're doing one sheets, like I used to work in marketing before I went into reporting, and we used to do one sheets. And if you're doing one sheets, right, like get the headline image, you know, and passed off as a piece of marketing collateral, like that seems like you might want to try to invest in some new skills.
Yeah. I also think that there's something beautiful about the person that is creating the thing. Like, let's say you're doing a piece of writing, or maybe you're a music artist and you made a song. I think there's something really beautiful about that person being able to connect their art, their graphics, as closely intertwined with the other kind of art that they're making. Like if I'm a music artist, I want to be able to choose the exact album art. I don't want to have to always outsource that to somebody who may not really understand what I want.
Yeah, it totally resonates, because like I've been using image generation for big technology. I'm a one person shop. Like I couldn't afford to do graphic design for every single story. I mean, I was hardly making it work with like the whatever iStock photo. And every now and again, I would, pay for the image. But like now it's like we get almost perfect illustrations every time for every story, because this technology has made that possible.
Right. You're able to marry the creative process of your podcast with the graphics and the thing you want to show people. And only you can go through as many iterations as you want to find the perfect thing that you think is like the right mapping. So I think I have actually talked to people like artists or people that draw who hate this stuff. Last year, I think like a year or two ago, I basically got almost canceled like on Reddit and Twitter and everywhere. Back when AI art was, you know, people hated the idea that you would even say AI art is art. And so one of the things I decided to do is be really curious. And I said, let me go talk to some of these people that, you know, basically are sending me death threats on Twitter or something like that. And, you know, some of these people love drawing. It doesn't matter that you offer them a better tool. They love the idea of picking up a pencil and drawing. And so for those people, certainly, you know, that's one way of making art. And some people will treasure that and enjoy that. But that would be taking something that they enjoy. They still can do it. They can still enjoy it. It just might not mean that it kind of doesn't evolve perhaps with the time. So there will be some people, I think it does matter to think a little bit about how fast the technology is moving and how people will deal with that.
Right. Definitely. Okay. Sorry. I didn't mean to break your momentum.
No worries. Yeah. So I think that those things will be possible. I think the utility of graphics are going to increase though significantly in the next year. I think that we haven't really thought through editing, for example. Right. A lot of this stuff is generating synthetic images, but we haven't really thought about like, what if I have an image and I want to add my dog who's not in the image for my holiday card? Could I take my dog from a different image and then just like insert it, where it gets all the lighting and the shadows and the color and all the ambiance? Correct. What if I want to do fantastical things? Like, what if I want to see what you would look like if you were the Incredible Hulk? Big green, but it really had your face, and you thought that face was your face.
Doesn't take much imagination to tell you the truth. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah. I think that, what if I want to make a logo? Logo's really hard. I mean, I remember having to pay, paid people $50,000 to just generate, to make a bunch of logos that I want to use to brand my product. Sometimes you can only get 5 of them though. Why can't I get 100 of them? I think with graphics, graphics is on this never ending, cycle where we never feel like it's good enough. If you can think a little bit about like PlayStation 1 and then PlayStation 2 and then 3, 4, 5, right? Grand Theft Auto, the first Grand Theft Auto to now maybe what 5 looks like. We can see that graphics is still improving 30 years later. So I think by giving people tools where they can do incredible feats of graphics, it's going to be really exciting. But I think graphics is only a subfield of a bigger plan that at least our company has. I don't know if there are other companies that care to do this, but our company cares about creating a unified vision model where we can create and edit and understand anything with pixels, a single unified model. This is missing in vision, but definitely kind of exists in language. In language, we can solve hundreds or thousands of different tasks, but in graphics, but in vision, it's all separated. It's kind of like where language was back 3 or 4 years ago, where there'd be a model that could summarize and a model that could do sentiment analysis and a model that could, do little, like these different little act tasks, but there wasn't a unified single large language model, but there's no equivalent for vision. What is a large vision model? We don't really have a term for that. So my feeling is that vision as a field is going to significantly expand. Why can't a robot look at images and navigate the world like a self-driving car, right? That's one thing. Why can't we understand images or what's going on better? We've seen early glimpses of that. I think there's like a famous picture of Barack Obama stepping on a scale and the model knows that Barack Obama is like trying to increase the scale. It's like a joke. But can models like really understand what's going on in these images to a much deeper level? So there's large vision models that are starting to incorporate language and images, but vision, there's no real all-encompassing multitask vision model.
So I have a couple of questions for you on this. First of all, well, on the vision part, does that sort of play into like a lot of people have been talking about how, one of the biggest applications of this current generation of AI is going to be in augmented reality, right? And like the Meta has those glasses where like you don't have an overlay right now, but you can talk to things, to their AI bot, and it will look at the world and then give you a sense as to like what you're looking at, or you can even just ask questions about things and it will talk to you. So I'm curious like how seriously you take this new era of augmented reality that we seem to be heading in, because speaking of one of your tweets, you wrote, it's going to be hard to beat a computer in your pocket you can use inconspicuously when you need to. So it sounds like you're a believer that the phone is going to be the way that we're going to interact with computing for a while, but maybe there's something I'm missing.
Yeah, I mean, I think the phone is a really good form factor of computing. I've talked to lots of different friends who've tried the Vision Pro and such. It seems like that's still kind of early in terms of its use cases and its utility. So we'll see what happens over the next year or two. I tend to be like more optimistic no matter what, because you never know about these things. I think one thing that Meta is doing, regardless of where VR is headed or AR is headed, is they have one of the most world-class teams for graphics, and they have to because of all the stuff that they're doing in VR.
Right.
I think it's kind of unclear what the right form factor is. Mm-hmm. Is it on your face? Is it somewhere else? Is it a thinner video screen? I'm not sure. But one thing I do feel pretty confident in is that we will care a lot about being able to use AI to manipulate graphics, regardless of the form factor. Like, I'm somewhat form factor agnostic. Is it a TV? Is it a watch? Is it glasses? Is it some new thing? I don't know. But it seems very likely that we're going to care. Like an example would be, I wish I could just go into a store, stand in front of a mirror, and then just sort of swipe for like a jacket that I'm wearing. I went this weekend to the De Young, and it had this like sort of fashion, San Francisco fashion exhibit. And there was this, powered by Snapchat thing where it would like put on a dress. And so I was in a dress at the exhibit. But it was really cool. And it's very obvious that this thing could be higher fidelity.
Right.
And that was like a really cool AR experience. But why can't I have that for jeans and a jacket or anything that I want to wear without having to try it on? So I think those kinds of experiences seem inevitable, regardless of the form factor.
Yeah. And then talking about the limitations of image generation models today, it just seems like they all end up generating images that look so similar. And, when I said before that, like, I generate the perfect image for each story, conceptually, yeah. But you can still tell that it's been generated by an AI image model and not a graphic designer. So I'm curious, like, why so much of these AI generated images from your perspective look so similar? Is it because they're using the same underlying technology, using the same training set? Is it just that they're not quality enough that people can pick them out? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, language models have this problem too.
Right.
Like the way that we know this is that language models are kind of overly verbose, right?
They talk a lot.
They talk a lot, right? So that's kind of the little tell for language models. For images, you know, the tells are a little bit different. Maybe they have overly crazy bouquets, or they are super lush in ways that you don't need them to be lush, right? But I think with images, you know, what's happening is that maybe the models are a little bit too curated. It's at its infancy, but I think that the models are probably too curated and maybe overfit to be based on human preference. Hmm. And human preference isn't your human preference. It's your preference, I mean. It's some kind of average of human preference. And so, you know, in art, there's art that we like in the modern time, and then there's kind of avant-garde art. And maybe you prefer that, right? You want something more ostentatious. Maybe you want something more minimal and laid back. And I think what we've kind of discovered is that actually, like, there are just huge wide varieties of preference. And then there's the average. And so I think with image models, it's somewhat twofold. It's that we're not catering to people's personalized preferences and styles. I think that's one problem, or the niches, right? And I think the other is that quality is the lowest it's ever going to be starting today, right?
Right.
So the quality is going to get incredibly good.
But it's interesting because, so having worked at publications where we did have graphic artists, right? Like, one of the interesting things was you would give a prompt, or that you'd write a story, and that artist would then sort of take it back and, based on their own style, end up creating an image. And I love doing this because I was seeing what they came up with, because I was always surprised by what they'd built, because they would do it through their own lens and focus. But what AI does, I think, is it tends to sort of take everything into account and spit back the average, right? Like, kind of like the average type of words or average image. And that's where I sort of say, you know, sometimes I'll be surprised by what an AI image generation engine will create, but oftentimes it's like, yeah, that sounds right, or that's close enough. Let's put it in the top of the story.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. Human graphics designers are also kind of overfit, right? They have their own particular style. Like, anytime I've reached out to a graphics designer, sometimes they'll say, hey, why did you reach out to me? Like, what did you like that I did? Mm-hmm. Or an interior designer or whoever, right? So they all have their style. They're kind of like these human graphics designers are somewhat like less robust designers in some sense. Like, they are very skewed to something, and then you pick them. And that's cool, because then it can lead to brandable things. The models, if you prompt them simply, then they will be an average style, that represents something. You will probably get, at this point, you will get something that is beautiful, but it might not be like stretched. It might not be headed in a stylistic direction, because everybody uses it. Then it feels kind of fatigued. It's like you know what I call it? I internally call this pop. It's like pop art.
Yeah.
Like, just pop music, top 40 music.
Exactly.
And then you like
great way to think about it.
Like, growls and noises and sounds, right? But then there's pop music. There's like Justin Bieber, that kind of thing. What you're getting from the image models is pop. And people love pop. We know that. Love top 40. But it's hard to market pop all the time, because it gets tiring. So yeah, and in this case, you know, it is definitely, the models are capable. It's just, you have to have like this perfect alchemy of figuring out the right prompt engineering.
Thing. But then, that's where it gets interesting then. Because then let's say, okay, you know, I like art in the style of a specific contemporary graphic designer.
Yeah.
And let's say the model's trained on that art. And I say, all right, you know, create an image of like a robot playing tennis in the style of, you know, person Y.
Sure.
But then you get into some really tricky questions, because we have to figure out a way to either compensate these people, because it's like, it really becomes like some sort of intellectual property theft. So I'm curious, like, you're running a company that does image generation. So how do you think about this?
Oh yeah, super, super interesting issue and really complex. You know, these days we're not really seeing customers, you know, wholesale be like, I want it in this person's this one person's name, you know, which is good. I think it's a good thing. You know, Greg Rakowski is someone that I think about in this case, because a lot of people add that person's name. He makes really amazing fantasy art that on DeviantArt, and maybe he's helped out some video game studios and stuff. I'm not sure. But his name is kind of quintessential in this debate. And, you know, what the reason why people are, it's important to understand the reason why people are doing it. People aren't doing it because they're trying to copy Greg Rakowski. They're doing it as a shortcut to get somewhere. Because if you take an image from Greg Rakowski, it's not easy to articulate. In fact, I mean, there's a reason why there's a phrase called, you know, picture speaks a thousand words. It's very hard to describe his art completely. We can come up with some words, but it's a vibe, it's a style. And so people are using it as a shortcut. And there's other people like H.R. Giger, who does like kind of more eerie, you know, worst type stuff. I've learned about a lot of artists because of how
I people can imagine. Are prompting. Yeah.
There's a lot. And you know, there's no easy way around this. But I think that this thing is going to go away in the next year, this year. I mean, we're working on something. I can't talk about it exactly right now. But I think this idea is that users are doing this because it's a shortcut to get to a very difficult to describe style. And what they really want is to say, I like this. Like, I want to reference this. I want to reference five of these different things and get to an image. Because actually with graphics and a lot of images and art, what's happening is like, it's like remixing a lot of things. Like because I make music, I can kind of relate to it, because it's sort of like, you know, if your inspiration is Kanye West and then your other inspiration is, you know, Dr. Dre, and then your other inspiration is, you know, Six, who produces music for Logic, and you want to combine like the drum rhythms of this person and the instrumentals of this person and the lyrics of this person, did you copy them? I mean, all of these people were inspired by people. And so I think in this case, people are just feeling inspired, but they're using a shortcut. So the question is, how do we get them away from just copying actual Greg Rakowski? Because that's definitely the wrong thing. We definitely don't want that in the world. Nobody should be copying Kanye, you know, wholesale. That's bad too.
Right. But you just kind of, it's difficult to eliminate the prompts completely. Like, let's say you did have audio generation, you know, and you could say, write me a song about, you know, I don't know, my girlfriend in the, you know, style of Kanye West.
Yeah.
I don't know why you'd want to do that, but you could. And, you know, you sort of get into those issues.
I do. Yeah, you definitely do. But I don't think that's people's true intent.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that the artists whose work is being trained on should be compensated?
I think we need to find some solution for them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, we do a small, you know, it's not clear, like, you know, every time you generate an image, they get like, you know, some Spotify streaming payment, you know, 1/1000th of a penny. I don't think anyone's going to be happy in that circumstance.
Right.
But, you know, we try to do something small. We don't think this is the solution. We don't think this is enough of a remedy per se, by any means, as a stretch of the imagination. But one thing we do that nobody seems to else to do is we actually link back to a lot of these artists.
Yeah.
When an image gets generated, we say additional credit, Greg Rakowski, and it links directly back to his DeviantArt page so that people can find him, learn about him, pay him, donate to him, whatever they want, right? We even link back to like Wikipedia artists that, you know, are no longer, or artists that are on Wikipedia that are not living, just so people understand what they're doing.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's a good start. Okay. So let me ask you this. You're doing an image generation startup. You're very focused. Like, you'll tweet often about how it's so important to stay focused. And I do think there's something to be said for that, because there's so many other companies that are just kind of going all over the place. Do you regret not doing video though? Because what we've seen out of OpenAI Sora and others is just kind of, you know, jaw dropping. It's pretty amazing. So is that something that now you think you should have done?
I mean, it's too soon to tell. You have to ask me in a year to find out if I regret it, right? Right now, I don't have any regret. It's funny. Where we are with video is kind of where we were with images. And I don't know if people remember, but about 2 years ago, DALL-E came out. DALL-E 2 came out in April. And the world was amazed. Totally amazed. But if anyone goes looks at a DALL-E 2 image
today, those images are awful.
Horrendous images. You would laugh.
Right.
Right. So when we see something like Sora come out, I've been having this personal reaction or a moment with all of this stuff, which is that my baseline for quality instantly resets. Like 15 minutes after the technology comes out, I'm just kind of like, anything worse than this is unacceptable. And my feeling is that we're only at the very beginning of video. And the truth is, if you could probably go talk to real video people, they'll be like, yeah, this is not good enough. This is definitely, I can't use this. People are going to have a lot of fun doing it, but the utility is probably not there yet. It's probably, we're really just at the beginning, I think, for video. So I think my feeling is, my bet to people, you know, sort of listening, is that in a year, we will think, you know, we'll think something like Sora was not even close.
Right. Yeah, it is amazing. I mean, that transition you talked about from DALL-E 2 to DALL-E 3. I mean, even going from DALL-E 2 to Midjourney, I was just like, I'll never type the word DALL-E in a Google search ever again. I don't want to get anywhere close to it. And it is, it's amazing. Right. I think you've pointed this out, how fast that we're moving, that these jaw-dropping breakthroughs become obsolete or like kind of looked at as unimpressive a few months later. That's the speed that this stuff is moving at.
Totally. And I think with, so that's video. So I don't have any worries about video, because I think video is still early. Like there's still maybe a moment where we can do videos. There's nothing. Right.
Seems like you'd be able to somewhat easily take what you've learned with images and go to video. Underrating it, but
yeah. I think, you know, without saying too much, I feel like probably where we're headed with images is not going to be like, it's not going to be like a completely, we have to restart and throw everything away to go do video. You know, to put it simply. I mean, we were trying to work to a unified vision model that incorporate 3D and video and everything related to pixels into a single model that's capable of everything. But I think for now, we're trying to start with something that's narrow and sharp that we think is deeply underinvested in.
Right.
We still think that images have a ways to go.
Let me ask you something about video before we go to break. Because there's a debate that I've been trying to wrap my head around, which is kind of this debate between Jan LeCun, who built this thing called VJEPA, right? Which will black out a portion of a video, and then the model with its understanding of the world will basically fill in what it should have been. So, you know, you have a guitar and someone seems to be playing it, black out the hand and the model will create the hand and the strings, showing that it has an understanding of the real world. They say that that's not generative, that that's actual real world understanding. And then on the other side, you have OpenAI, that's created Sora, and it's this pretty amazing thing where, like, clearly this model understands the physics of what's happening, because the pirate ships are, you know, sloshing around in a cup of coffee ocean, and it's like, oh, they understand that the ships belong in the ocean, and this is the way the ocean moves, and this is the way the ships should interact with the water. It's so impressive, and it seems like it also understands the world. But you ask the Meta folks, and they would say that actually that process of generating these videos is actually limited and doesn't achieve what the AI research community is trying to achieve. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I haven't studied Jan's VJEPA thing too deeply, but I get the gist of it. I mean, I would posit this to you. Are you sure it understands physics?
No.
Because
let me stand on the side of that it does, and then you can sort of take this argument down. I mean, come on, like, boats in the water, the water's coffee, you know?
Right.
All right, yeah, that's my argument. What do you have to say?
Well, I mean, it's not too difficult to refute, in part because, like, just imagine that there's video. And the video represents the physics of a different world, like Mars, right? And even though there are natural physics to Mars, they don't necessarily represent the physics of Earth. They represent some physics. It just happens to not be Earth. And so I would say you could just pull that thread a little bit longer and just say, actually, what it's really doing is it's representing the physics it understands in the videos it's being trained on, which could be incorrect physics. It's really what it understands, what it's being trained on is the main thrust of my point. And that, to a human, to us, it looks like physics. It's imitating physics. And it's not necessarily imitating correct physics.
Right.
So it's really mimicking an understanding of its training data. And likely, and if there's any training data that's like cool CG or like, you know, the Matrix where Neo's like bent, you know, on his back, that's not real physics of our world. But it models its training data. And I think that that's totally fine, though. For a tool that's meant for creativity, that's acceptable. But can we really say that it has learned physics? I can't say that. I don't think we can, not yet. You know, maybe lighting, but even the videos that have lighting could have incorrect lighting.
Right.
Yeah.
It is so interesting. On and so forth. Yeah. I think that the folks that I speak with in the AI community are really divided on this. Like we had Brian Cannizzaro from NVIDIA a little bit back. He runs applied machine learning there. And he's like implying some metaphysical capabilities in these large language models where, whereas like others would say that it's just predicting the next word. And this could be the same thing where like, We're still so early on and still trying to figure out like what's happening in these advances that it's still an open question. Or maybe I'm just giving the people who disagree with you too much credit.
I take like a very different argument than these like two different factions.
Yeah. Okay.
I take the argument that it doesn't, I don't think it matters.
Right.
Like at the end of the day, we are making these models could do it or could not. But either way, what matters is what utility it brings to humanity. And if what it brings is this amazing, you know, creative tool to create super slow motion action shots for the next Matrix movie, that's fine. And if it can truly model physics in the real world because we want to simulate what might happen with self-driving cars at a faster speed than actually having the cars be out in the world, so be it. To me, it doesn't matter. It's kind of irrelevant. What matters more is its value to us as humans. And I think we're a little like too deep on a philosophical level about whether, you know, it's this or that.
The reason why I ask the philosophy questions is that they matter from my perspective in terms of like what you can do next. Like if it does understand physics, then you can imagine or anticipate that it will be able to do more than if it doesn't. But it's definitely interesting.
I guess I'm trying to say that it can do both.
Right. No, no.
So anything is really like the options are kind of wide open.
Definitely. Okay, let's take a break. When we come back, I want to do a quick lightning round through the tech giants and also talk a little bit about one of the tech giants, the state of Google. So why don't we do that when we come back right after this?
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. In the last 100 years, we've seen financial markets swing, new currencies come and go, decades of savings lost in days, all showing that a retirement plan without a guarantee, quite simply, isn't enough. So more than a retirement plan, TIAA makes you a retirement promise. A promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. A promise that pays off. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff. The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by HubSpot. More to-dos, less time, and so many tools to keep track of. Doing business can be hard, but you don't need a miracle to hit your goals. You just need HubSpot. Their all-in-one customer platform can make growing your business infinitely easier. Imagine this: higher quality leads, fast closing deals, wildly happy customers, and more benchmark-breaking quarters. It's not a miracle. It's HubSpot. Visit HubSpot.com to get started today.
And we're back here on Big Technology Podcast. We're here with Suhail Doshi. He's the CEO and founder of Playground. We talked a little bit about image generation in the beginning. In the time we have left, let's go rather quickly through the tech giants. I'll start with Google because Google's been sort of like the punching bag of the AI community for a while. Suhail, you even had a tweet that says, Google's lost its way. It's the best company to compete with. Even investors have stopped asking, what if Google does it? I mean, Google did just start doing image generation. They had to shut it down. What is happening there?
Oh man, I wish, you know, obviously I only have a slight preview into what's going on at Google, but you know, my guess as to what feels like is happening is they are in a significant race where either investors or customers believe that by losing this race, it's an existential issue. Time will tell, however. And Google's rushing to be a strong leader in that race. And they have to contend with a significant complex bureaucracy that is not really well attuned for the velocity that AI is running at right now.
Hmm. So it's organizational. I've wondered how much of it is because Google sees a threat to search over time if it pushes the status quo forward too quickly. And right before we were talking, I was on CNBC talking about the state of Google, and I was absolutely floored by one of the numbers that Deidre Brosa, who's an anchor there, brought up, which is that I think Gartner believes that by 2026, we will be doing 26% less searches than we are today, or search engines will have 26% less traffic. I know you're connected with Perplexity in some way. We just said Aravind Srinivas. I'm kind of floored by that number. I don't believe it. I think that search is going to continue to be a way that we use web navigation, and AI search like Perplexity will be more to satisfy curiosity and engage with different topics. What do you think about the stat? And what do you think about that argument that I'm making?
I mean, I think there's a very high probability it is greater than that number in a shorter span of time.
Whoa, for real? That we'll be doing even fewer, that search engines will have even less traffic than, or even an even greater decline than 25%.
That's right.
And that will happen before 2026. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Because let's think about the model jump so far, right? We've got DALL-E 2 in April, 2 years ago. Look at the difference between that and any cutting edge model. We can look at GPT-3, which was 4 years ago. And now we have GPT-4. GPT-5 is probably slated imminently this year. The jump from 4 to 3 was incredible. And I think the reason why I believe this perhaps this very surprising thing is because I don't think people quite internalize how big of a jump can be had still. Like, we're still so at the beginning, the early phases of this thing, that It is moving faster than Moore's law by a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest people right now are putting in huge quantities of money. I think I already find it annoying to have to go to Google and like run through a few links and then click and then back and then click and then back. And then, there's an ad here. Okay, let me scroll down. You know, I think humanity already can tell it's frustrating. So If you were to go, this thing is already kind of inefficient, somewhat frustrating. In fact, like, I just want the answer. I don't want to have to find the answer, right? I think that's the problem these things are solving. And you look at the model jumps, right, over the last 3-4 years, it doesn't seem surprising that like almost all the traffic would shift to something that is, I mean, Google has very low switching costs. I mean, right now it happens to be integrated well in the browser. Right. It happens to be, but actually the funny thing about Google is like, it has slightly less lock-in and ease on mobile, and most consumer traffic, desktop is shrinking for consumer while mobile's dramatically increasing.
Well, they do have Android
many times.
Yeah.
We do have Android, but we're talking about, you know, whether Google search matters. Like, Google could make a model that matters and is relevant. But it still might spell the end of its search business. So in my general feeling about this is that the UX of like something like Perplexity, we've already figured out, is like a nice UX. And you combine that with another model jump like GPT-5 or 6, it doesn't seem that crazy to me that we end this desire of going to Google and then scrolling through blue links and clicking on each of them.
Is your default search engine Google or something else?
Oh, certainly it's Google. But I've already shifted so much. It's not my first go-to.
Right.
Right. Unless I want to go to a very specific site. I mean, people going to their address bar inside of a browser or phone to search a website that they're trying to go to is just, they're not really using Google's value. They're just, you know,
right.
It's like my dad used to type in CNN.com into Google and you could just type it in the address bar. It's not a real search.
Yeah.
Right. I already think it's not really a great go-to.
Interesting. Okay. Another thing that you said, let's go to Meta. You said the only thing scarier than Satya is Mark Zuckerberg taking AI seriously. Unpack that.
Well, I feel like Mark has been very focused on VR because he's trying to do something that I think, you know, just regardless of your view of whether VR is going to succeed or not, it's ambitious if he succeeds. And I think he's like a very relentless entrepreneur and founder. So, and he's one of the few entrepreneurs and founders that are like running a $1 trillion plus company. There's not that many left. So
yeah,
I feel, you know, I somewhat feel like
it's him and Jensen, I think.
Yeah. And he's very young still. So I think that, you know, for him to take AI, and the thing about Meta is it is super set up to succeed at this. They have the world's, they're like the first, second biggest research lab. They have an immense quantity of compute that's only growing. I mean, I think he talked about having 350,000 H100s by the end of the year or something like that.
Yeah. And they're going to have total 650,000 either GPU like equivalents by I think the end of the year, which is crazy.
Yeah, he's got an extremely ambitious AI research leader.
I mean, that's a lot of GPUs.
That's a lot.
How many do you guys have?
No, not anywhere close to that.
I mean, more than 1,000?
Not more than 1,000.
Right. So it's just
the
crazy. I mean, speaking with ServiceNow also, which is their 150 billion, 160 billion public company, like they wouldn't say that they have in the thousands in an interview that I did with them. So to have 600,000 it's crazy.
Yeah. I just think that, you know, you combine founder with relentless ambition, with compute, with the best talent. You know, to me, it's a recipe that is hard to, I mean, and then you compare that with Google, you know, it feels a little like, you know, to me, it feels like they're a force to be reckoned with in the next few years.
Okay, let's talk about NVIDIA. Speaking of Jensen, I want to test an assumption here. I recently have found out that the software that they sell along with their chips is core to training AI models. And that makes switching away a lot more difficult. Is that something that you're finding in your business, that you're using the chips and the software to train models and you'd have a hard time switching to like an AMD?
Yeah, the software is called CUDA and it's like their platform for doing all kinds of it's their way of interfacing with their GPUs. And so, you know, it has lock-in in the sense that there's like a huge developer community around it, just like x86 or something like that. You know, maybe there's... you know, software that's really tuned and optimized for x86. So that's what causes people to kind of stay on it. With CUDA, you know, it's not CUDA that's keeping a lot of us. It's actually that there is nothing really dramatically better than NVIDIA's GPUs. And so, you know, if there's nothing dramatically better, then, I mean, the reality is the cost for training and inference are so high at companies at scale that CUDA is not like a big reason why you're going to stay there. It's going to come down to compute costs. And so if there were somebody that were really driving the costs down for the rest of us, we would all flip because it would be worth it. So to me, it's not just a function of CUDA. You know, I think that is true to some extent, but I think for the big companies or anyone spending a lot of money, you know, we all want there to be someone that can compete with NVIDIA. Because one of the problems with NVIDIA was that they, you know, released their H100, but they didn't really reduce its cost. You know, it's 1.9x faster, but 2x costlier. And it technically reduces your cost because you're getting more GPU compute per node. Like you have a server costs a finite amount. Well, now you can put more of the GPU dense compute per node. So your costs go down. But they didn't really price their GPUs lower. So that's somewhat disappointing because it would have been nice if it was the same price, but double the compute, obviously. So NVIDIA knows what they have.
Right. And so what about a company like Amazon? They're obviously developing their own chip. They're making models available off the shelf. People are using AWS compute, I imagine, to run models. What's your perspective on Amazon's place here? I mean, they also have Alexa, which is like, you know, a sleeping giant.
Yeah, I mean, I think AWS has significantly missed the mark actually on this.
Okay.
I think that Azure and GCP are doing Azure better than GCP, better than AWS. AWS is interesting. I mean, we were looking for compute last year, and AWS wanted to charge us 5 times more for the same GPU than 10 different providers all around them.
Wow. I mean,
would you stop at a gas station that cost you 5 times more than the one that's right next to it?
I would speed by it, throw an egg.
Right. And that's kind of what, and you know, I think what's happening there is that, you know, this is my insights. So I hope it's helpful for someone, but my guess is that they have a scarce stockpile of GPUs and they know that they can price those GPUs internally. They can price them to their internal customers at that price. And the customers will buy it because the customers can't go anywhere else. You know, maybe because they're not allowed to in their company. So then they can charge five times more. And that's what the sales reps are doing. But if you are a new customer, we have choices.
You're not doing that.
You're not going to do that. But the sales reps will do it because right. it helps them reach, you know, quota.
That's crazy.
So I think there's a short term, there's a sort of short, it kind of feels like ever since Andy Jassy became CEO, AWS has turned very short term minded. About how it's going to earn revenue. And this is obviously bad because anyone that knows anything about startups knows that the biggest companies are yet to be built, but they're definitely going to not be running on AWS if their compute is five times more expensive.
Wow. Yeah, that's crazy. And I wonder what that means for startups like Anthropic that are, you know, have billions of funding from Amazon and are going there.
Well, that they might be priced be a strategic at 3-5x.
Exactly. Yeah. let's talk Apple real quick. I wonder what they're going to do with AI. I mean, they're hinting that they're going to do something at WWDC. It's like they're going to make a supercharged Siri or, you know, take the search bar away from Google and then give up on all that money they're getting. They have some incumbency advantage, disadvantage, don't they? Because if they really push hard on AI to, you know, take up more room in the operating system, then they can crowd out some of the advantages that they have today.
Yeah, I mean, I think Apple is in a really good position because their culture is already seemingly like one where they wait and see. Mm. And their advantages are not easily eroded because they own the hardware platform and all the network effects that are associated with that. So Apple seems like they're in a really healthy position to wait and see and build the best things, not just build kind of like aimlessly. You know, Google feels like it's just trying to build everything. Yeah. Right? They're building Image Gen and Gemini and the coding, and they're building an IDE, and you know, they're like asked all the PMs clearly to like integrate it this week into like every imaginable product. I opened Gmail, I opened Docs, I opened so many different random Google things, and they're all trying to convince me to use AI. And I think Apple is super well positioned to just like let Google do all those experiments. And then just pluck the ones that are the best ones and use its massive install base and distribution power to deliver an amazing experience, not a rushed one.
Right.
So I think Apple is behind, but I think that they are often okay being behind and they execute very well kind of from behind because they find ways to leap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk lastly about Microsoft and OpenAI. You know, you gave a pretty strong statement about Amazon. I'm curious what you would think, what you think about the current offering from those companies. I mean, obviously, you're competing with them on the image gen front. And also just like, from your sense, do you think that the OpenAI situation is stable right now, or are there going to be more fireworks on the governance side there?
You know, I think that the folks at OpenAI really only care about one thing. I think people don't fully internalize this because it seems a little too crazy. It seems like sometimes when you read a company's mission, you're like, whatever. But I think that Sam is genuinely focused on AGI and attaining that. And I think he does not care about graphics and, you know, video necessarily. I think those are stepping stones. And that helps research, you know, get to the next point. But I think he is very focused on that. And so I think, you know, broadly, we don't tend to worry about that because we're pouring all of our energy into graphics. I can't say much about Microsoft, but I can just say that I, you know, genuinely believe that OpenAI is trying to pursue that effort. I can't tell whether that'll be 3 years from now or 30 years from now, though.
Yeah.
In terms of what Microsoft's doing, yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure. But brilliant play by Satya, either way.
Seriously. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, no matter what happens.
To be the most valuable company in the world. They seem like they're the tech giant that's in the best position right now, which is wild given where they were like 7 years ago, 8 years ago.
And also just very surprising because it's right. Like if they had not done that, they would have been maybe in the worst position.
Totally. I mean, being aggressive sometimes, it matters. They've learned their lesson, right? They sat by and tried to ride Windows for as long as they could. And then people were like, yeah, we don't want to use desktop operating systems anymore. And they're like, right. Oh, yeah. Well, that's interesting. Okay. And
right.
And the person that led that shift from, you know, one era of computing to another was Satya in the server and tools division. So here he goes again.
Yeah. You know, he is doing something that I find that's even like slightly even more brilliant, which is not just the OpenAI deal, but if you observe very carefully, he is actually partnering with everybody. Hmm. He is bringing all the models into Azure.
Right.
And he's doing it very methodically. And I think that he is really setting up Azure to be, to leap and be a lot more competitive. So I actually think that he's doing a really good job kind of playing every field.
Yeah.
And positioning himself kind of in the middle, positioning Microsoft, kind of in the middle of all that. So, you know, game recognized game to Satya.
Totally. All right. Just to end, I want to say that I actually reached out to you initially when you had a tweet advising founders that, you know, if you're going to speak with a journalist, speak with someone who's independent. And I certainly am independent, and I DM'd you and I was like, so, and you lived up to your word. So I appreciate that. And I'd also say that like these conversations are super valuable. And I think that speaking with journalists inside, we're probably not going to agree on this one. So it could be a different conversation, but speaking with journalists inside some of the corporate media, I don't think they're all out to get tech founders. Especially off the record conversations, sort of like if there's a divide between founders and reporters, then the misunderstandings will just grow. But anyway, that's just my piece. So I appreciate you being here though, but go ahead.
Yeah. I think that's sort of the real issue is not that, you know, the individual reporter is a bad person. Like,
yeah.
I think they're all like well-meaning, well-intentioned. So if we have conversations with them, right, if you have a conversation over drinks or dinner, whatever, they're obviously good people, good, well-meaning people working hard. That's not so much the issue that a lot of us that basically think that you should largely stop talking to the institutional media have. It's not that we think they're bad. It's that we think that their institutions are bad. And their institutions create incentives that create bad situations. Where like they, you know, like what is the cause? You know, we should also be a little bit curious, like what is the cause that causes a reporter to write a story and then email you and say, you know, do you have a comment? And then publish the story 1 hour later. What is the cause for that? You know, is that person a bad person? Probably not. That person is under some kind of deadline or incentive or pressure that is causing this thing. And this particular, I pick on this instance because it's a very obvious one that everybody knows is bad, is not well, you know, that has really bad implications. They're not giving founders to respond to something. And it's happened to a lot of my friends, a lot of other people talk about this. So, you know, I think that's the real issue. And that's why, you know, you could just as well work at, you know, any of these media institutions, but the fact that you're independent causes your incentives and your desires of what you want to write and what you want to do to be totally different. And the reporters that used to work at some of these institutions that have struck it out on their own, like you, you can see it all get cleaned up, right? They completely change what they write, what their beats are, and how they work and interact with other people in the world. So I think it's a lot better, more factual, more interesting reporting.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, like, I obviously am competing against like the broader media ecosystem. So I do hear you on that front. Anyway, it's something that we could talk about forever. It is good to hear your perspective on it. And once again, I appreciate that you put something out there in the world. And then when I was like, all right, let's talk, you said yes. So I hope this isn't the last time. I hope to have you back. And so thrilled that you were able to come on and join and talk about all the new stuff that you're working on in the broader industry. It's like, it's cool to be able to speak with someone who like you read their stuff on Twitter and then like you have a conversation like this. goes longer than an hour, and it could easily go two or more. So the substance is there, and appreciate you being here. Thanks again, Soil.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening. We'll be back on Friday to break down the news as we do every week, and we'll see you next time on Big Technology Podcast.